Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 50, section 7, which is old single column, page 578. All right, before we read this last little section, remember how we almost got all the way through this paper last time. That preceding section, you know, that's entitled Planetary Culture, remember how it had scant information that seemed to be directly illuminating what you're expecting the content to be based upon the title of the section. Supposedly, this is a section about planetary culture, and instead, it was a lot about, you know, us being the victims of rebellion and default. Okay. Now we noticed that one of the reasons, of course, is you know, there's a lot that they can't tell us, like they said at the beginning of that section, about the diversity of cultures on different planets. You know, if you reflect on it, it's not as non sequitur as it might initially seem to be. You know, the point is, the culture of this planet is very much in the context of rebellion and default. Remember, they decided to even, you know, in giving a name for this local system. You know, they didn't name this local system in some sort of a transcendent way that reflects its differential relative to other local systems or whatnot. They, you know, they named it just purely from our experiential perspective. They gave us an English name for our local system, Satania, the nation of adversity. You know, or the people of the place of adversity. Depending on how you want to translate that, but the key, you know, root is adversity. You know, that the culture in this local system has a lot to do with adversity, and you know, obviously this planet, being one of the 37 rebellion worlds, has a lot to do with adversity. So that was the point they made. You know, and by and large, it was speaking to, you know, the negative fact of rebellion and default. So, you know, this section that follows it sees the contrast with that. It isn't all negative that we're isolated. There are rewards of isolation as well. So, you know, the title of this last section only makes sense, see, in that juxtaposition context. All right, so let's, for those who are familiar, everyone knows this is a section that's got a fun word italicized twice in it that we all love to talk about. Yeah, let's get into this and see. You can unpack this in many ways. We're going to do it as much in the context of this paper as possible.
7. The rewards of isolation. On first thought, it might appear that Urantia and its associated isolated worlds are most unfortunate in being deprived of the beneficent presence and influence of such superhuman personalities as a planetary prince and a material son and daughter. But isolation of these spheres affords their races a unique opportunity for the exercise of faith and for the development of a peculiar quality of confidence in cosmic reliability, which is not dependent on sight or any other material consideration. It may turn out, eventually, that mortal creatures hailing from the worlds quarantined in consequence of rebellion are extremely fortunate. We have discovered that such ascenders are very early entrusted with numerous special assignments to cosmic undertakings where unquestioned faith and sublime confidence are essential to achievement.
Okay. So notice that they made a point of stressing a particular element twice there, right in the middle and then at the end. They say at the end, assignments to cosmic undertakings, not scientific undertakings, not religious undertakings, spiritual undertakings, cosmic undertakings. And they give a twofoldness both times. They had exercise of faith in the middle here. At the end, they have unquestioned faith. And at the end, they say sublime confidence. And in the middle there, the development of a peculiar quality of confidence in cosmic reliability. Okay, so we want to reflect for a while on that, to really appreciate not only why this paragraph is juxtaposed, or this section is juxtaposed to the previous section, but why it's in this paper. Why did they decide to tell you those facts in this paper? That bit about develop a peculiar quality of confidence, which is not dependent on sight or any other material consideration. Okay, if it's not dependent on sight, that should be a clue. What are they talking about? Insight. Yeah. All right. So we have a peculiar opportunity to develop insight and to exercise faith that the run-of-the-mill individual doesn't have. The bit about the insight, that's pretty straightforward. I mean, just obviously, like they just said directly, if you don't have all these things that you can see and touch, you can walk up and give Adam and Eve a hug, right, and sit down and have a chat with them, right, or the prince's staff, right, very tangible, very visible, very in your face, helping you have a better relationship with the cosmos, a more logical relationship to the cosmos. So obviously, we have the opportunity to develop insight where others just wouldn't naturally tend to develop that level of insight because they're using sight as a crutch. Having a prince and his staff and an Adam and Eve, all good things taken to extreme become bad. I mean, you can tend in your to be an ease-drifting soul and just, lean on them as a crutch. That's the way most worlds are. But coincidentally, not all worlds are that way, because there's no way you're going to flesh out the completeness of supremacy. I mean, it just seems immediately illogical. If every world was like that, right, how could you ever plumb the depths of potential insight? If there was always a ready crutch at hand, right, a ready set of binoculars, but what if there aren't any binoculars? And you have to penetrate the cosmos without those binoculars of a prince and his staff and an Adam and an Eve, or a telescope, whichever analogy you want to use. All right, so that's just a little bit of reflection. It's apparent that there's this great stimulus here. I mean, yes, it's an opportunity, but we are just inexorably being pushed into that, acquiring insight. If nothing, in our frustration, we will dig deeper for a solution. Okay. But what about the faith thing? A unique opportunity for the exercise of faith. And that should leave you just puzzling. What on earth would be the unique opportunity to exercise faith? I mean, right, we exercise faith every day, but what's so unique about this opportunity? How are you using faith that the run-of-the-mill individual on a normal world never uses faith that way? Okay, to really appreciate that, we've got to go back and think again about those developmental epochs. Now, so let's just do that. Flip back to section 5. And for those who, you know, who weren't here as we went through those in detail, let me just do a little quick step through to get up to the point where the opportunity is waiting to recognize what this unique opportunity to exercise faith is. Okay, so remember, besides, you know, reflecting on how these developmental epochs are inexorably, not simplistically one for one in parallel, but nonetheless, because it's sweeping through the span of time, it ends up being parallel to the planetary mortal epochs, right? And so there's, you know, we remember that was one of the things that we pointed out, how there's an obvious opportunity with each of these for each of those developmental epochs to synchronize with each of those planetary mortal epochs to synchronize with one of these developmental epochs. But the thing we want to go back, what we want to go back to most specifically is that other parallel that we were playing with. You know, that other rough analogy. Again, it's not a one-for-one thing, but the levels of meaning and how we could recognize that as a planet moves through these developmental epochs, you at least have the leading edge of that planet moving collectively up those levels of meaning. Right? And so let's just remember how that basically goes. So if you start with the nutrition epoch, that first developmental epoch, remember how we set this up last time. So you start out, everyone has their feet planted, everyone is standing on the zeroth level of meaning, right? That basic mechanical level of your individuality. And so eye level is the first level of meaning. You know, what's sort of right in front of you? What are you immediately concerned with? It's right in front of your face on the first level of meaning, the level of the flesh. I'm hungry. Right. You're hungry. Okay. Food. Right. That chiefly concerned with food problems. Right. Okay. So you're standing on the zeroth and your eye level on the first. Okay. So let's say you deal basically with that basic level of the flesh issue. So now it has an integrity to it, right? It's not all quicksandy because it's hungry, right? It's solid, so you can stand on it. So you can stand on the first level of meaning, and now the second level of meaning is at eye level, right? So now we're moving to the security age, right? So what's the first thing that it's going to be going on now in front of your eyes? You know, what's going to be your chief concern now? Well, I mean, you're still basically dealing with fear. I mean, you've just exalted it a little bit from the zeroth level of meaning, where it's just foundational fear, you know, across the first level of meaning from anguish to dread. So, you know, you've amped up fear to dread now, right? And you got a lot of dread about those other people out there, right? And you're looking at the level of the feelings. You have feelings of insecurity, right? Remember, that's basically what's going on there. So that's what's, the engine behind the security age. You've got these very in-your-face feelings of insecurity predicated on dread, okay? All right, so what if you deal with that basic issue? What if you get that solidified a little bit. So you can stand on that, okay? And you can move to the material comfort era. You can move to the third developmental epoch here. Okay, so now I'm standing on the level of the feelings, standing on the second level of meaning. And, right, and if I'm fully standing, eye level now is the third level of meaning, right? And I've got that seventh adjutant on the third level of meaning staring me right in the face. However, you know, remember how the story went. You know, if you look back through that block there about the material comfort era, like especially, you know, they kind of emphasize at the end. Remember, there's a bifurcation for the first time. There's an option at hand that wasn't there before, right? And you had, you were splitting mankind into two groups. Gradually, these pleasure-seeking weaklings, okay, on the one side, are subjugated by the more strong and truth-loving elements of the advancing civilization. The weak on one side, the strong on the other. And what's fundamentally, what do we mean by weak here? You know, their biceps aren't very big. What do we mean? Okay. And we talked a lot about that a lot, but remember how the basic way you can do it, you know, understand it in our analogy that we're painting here. Okay, you actually get up there where you can potentially plant your feet on the level of the feelings. Okay, and you're now intimate with the level of feelings. And that could become very, very all-consuming. You know, and we couldn't help but think of Barry Manilow, right? I mean, feelings, nothing more than feelings, right? I mean, it's just feelings can easily entice you as a complete lifestyle solution. And you don't want to stand on the level of the feelings. You want to lay down on the level of the feelings. You want to immerse yourself in feelings, right? And you think about the three adjutants, the three impulses that are on that level. The scientific impulse. Maybe you want to just immerse yourself in the scientific impulse. Maybe you want to just immerse yourself in the social impulse, the fifth adjutant. Or maybe you want to immerse yourself in the religious impulse, the sixth adjutant. Lots and lots of people, when they discover the energy of the sixth adjutant, want to lay down and bliss out in the feelings that it produces, right, and just stay there forever. Right? Well, if they're doing that, you know, if you're fixated on feelings, if you're laying down on the level of the feelings, if you're not standing up, the philosophic impulse, the seventh adjutant, is not in front of your face. You don't demonstrate any interest in figuring out where that impulse pushes you, where that goes, where that leads. Right? Okay, but if you are strong, right? If you can resist feelings being an end in themselves, and if you can, at least initially, if you're strong, right, you're looking at the philosophic impulse, you know, and you begin to follow it towards truth. Okay, laying down there with the religious impulse is not going to get you any truth. Right? Other than what you, that tiny little thread of existential truth that you have relationship to by grace, you know, and that's, you're just blissing in the stasis of it when you're down there. Okay. But dynamic truth, right, no. Okay, but let's say you are one of the strong truth-loving elements in the cosmic system. Okay, and you are standing up, and you go, and you want to take it to the next level. Well, if you're on this planet, you didn't get very much biologic uplift. You didn't get the strengthening of relationship to the seventh adjutant that you were supposed to have gotten. Okay? So, two things. One, it's just not going to be natural, because you have so limited relationship to the seventh, biologically, no biologic uplift, it's just not natural that you're just going to naturally gravitate upward to where your feet are on the third level of meaning. And even if it was, even if you imagined it was natural, that you kind of just, you know, slowly or progressed up to where finally your feet are on the third level of meaning, it's not solid. There's really not much to stand on there, if anything. So even if I'm, you know, very moved by the philosophic impulse, on this world, I really can't stand on the third level of meaning, because it's Swiss cheese because of Adam and Eve. So how am I going to get past this barrier? It seems like a barrier, right? How can I get to the fourth developmental epic and get into the quest for knowledge and wisdom, where I'm standing on the third, and now I have the logical acumen of the fourth level of meaning, you know, staring me in the face? How am I going to get there? If I can't stand on the third, I have another way to do it. I can reach up with my faith grasp and take a hold of the fourth level of meaning. Even if I can't stand on the third, I can get myself at eye level to the fourth by taking a hold of it with my upward grasp, my faith grasp, and doing a chin up, right? And holding myself there. That's what they're talking about. That is the unique opportunity for the exercise of faith. Because you can't really stand on the third, and yet you've got to get from the material comfort era to the quest for knowledge and wisdom. You can hang on the fourth, you know, and your feet are basically there, you know, on the third, but you're not standing. That's what they're talking about, to overcome that blockage. Remember, that's the why you're given the faith grasp initially. It's to overcome your subjective limitations. And here you see, we even have the opportunity to overcome even more than that, you know, our literal biologic limitations. Adam and Eve don't have to be a fundamental limitation. Right? You can overcome that. You know, and if you can hold on and get the quest for knowledge and wisdom going, follow the lure of that first cosmic intuition that's now before your eyes, you know, you will be grown up, and you'll get to the fifth developmental epic here, the epic of philosophy and brotherhood, like we talked about, and you can stand on the fourth, right? No biologic limitation prevents you from standing on the fourth, because now those levels, right, the fourth, fifth, and sixth levels, are there because they've come from the top down. They've come from the creative Mother Spirit down within you. She's put those three cosmic intuitions and those three levels in you. You know, they don't rest upon the biologic foundation. They rest upon the cosmos. They rest upon the upholder, her, right? Remember, you know, you have to really think about yourself flipping around, right? You know, in some analogies, you know, where you're trying to get your feet planted on the cosmos rather than on, you know, the dirt of your origin.
Is that what you mean by cosmic?
Right, and you know, and as we saw, you know, as we were reading that last time, remember how they said civilization has really arrived, you know, when they had the quest for knowledge and wisdom there, and obviously, you know, it's going to be really arriving when you get to philosophy and brotherhood. Remember, you as you start to bring in that objective consciousness as a collective phenomenon. And, you know, and then remember, just, you know, we don't need it for this to understand this right now, but just, you know, it goes on like that, where with number five, you're standing on the fourth, and the fifth is at eye level. That's why it talks about moral, because the moral discrimination is now at eye level. And then for number six, now you're standing on five, and the spiritual insight, you know, is in front of you. You know, the spiritual level is in front of you, so no wonder it's the age of spiritual striving, right? I mean, that's what's motivating you. So that's what's in front of you. And then for seven, you're now standing on the sixth, and the cosmos is at eye level, and you can begin to actually engage the cosmos directly rather than indirectly, you know, once you're standing at the top. But the key is, how do you get from the lower domain of the hourglass through the neck to the upper? You know, if...
On this world.
On this world. Right? And depending on how you're playing the analogy, you know, in different circumstances, you can picture that you hit a ceiling that you can't penetrate. You know, or here we're using the analogy that it's really just, you know, it's too fragile to stand on. You know, whatever way you want to play it, you know, that's the basic thing, is it, you know, to bridge this gap from subjective to objective, when you don't have a natural way to do that, where it just doesn't come naturally. When you have the full biologic uplift, you just naturally bridge that gap, and you just naturally, you know, progress from subjectivity to objectivity. You know, you've got to definitively choose it here, because you have to hold yourself up, you know, to get the beginnings of objective consciousness at eye level. You have to use the faith grasp to hold yourself. Take a hold of the Holy Spirit, right, with that spirit grasping mechanism, right? That's why that's here. Normal worlds, they don't have to exercise faith like that. They just find themselves standing on the third level of meaning, and no one thinks anything of it. They just take that for granted. Yep.
Well, the odd thing is, when you're at the subjective level, this faith grasp appears an illogical
mm-hmm.
thing. Right. It appears illogical to reach up with faith.
Yeah, because it seems like there's nothing up there.
That's right.
Yes. Yes. But once you pull yourself up, coincidentally, it becomes logical, because you're literally now staring the logical acumen.
There is something there.
Right, in the face, right. And, right, until you have to just do that. It's like, trust me, just reach up there, close your fist, and do a chin up. And then your eyes will be opened, right? And your objective eyes will be opened, and it will suddenly become trivially logical and obvious what before was inscrutable. You know, like sometimes we use the analogy, you know, you're standing there on the second level of meaning, and you look up, you go, no, there's nothing up there, it just goes to a point. Might as well just lay down and bliss out. Right? And that's what most people do. You know, because if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. Right? No, you need to have insight a little bit to begin with. See? You know, I mean, remember, fundamentally, the exercise of faith involves using the third cosmic intuition, you know, and that initial encirclement that you have with it by grace. You know, here we're talking about what you're going to take to light in doing beyond the grace level. But just to exercise faith at all requires personality and the third cosmic intuition, because it's personal recognition. Personal, there's your personality. Recognition, there's the third cosmic intuition. You know, the fundamental recognition that there is something that can be taken a hold of. Value is a substance that you can grasp. So that's what they're hoping, that eventually you'll put all these pieces together and understand why they put this here. You know? If all they wanted to do is tell you about what they're about to tell you about in the next paragraph, you know, you think, well, it could be anywhere. But see, it's only immediately understandable right in this context. Like I said, you want to reflect and reflect and reflect some more on section 5. Get this, you know, not only just memorize the names that they've given to the epics, the developmental epics, but you've got to get into the logic of them, the truth of them, so you can think in them and begin to understand in them. You know, use what you have in front of you with them, with the developmental epics, to foster your greater understanding of levels of meaning, and vice versa. You know, and likewise with the planetary mortal epics. Play them back and forth. Begin to understand the truth of these things, rather than all these things just being a set of 7 fact elements, which is of no use to you, right? You can't obey fact. Right? You got to get the truth of these things, which you can live, which you can obey, you know, so that the revelation becomes alive, right? And immediately, like we talked about last time, you can begin to understand what's going on in the world around you, right? You know, that we're in the material comfort era, and that's not evil. That's the Father's way, like we were talking about, like we spent a lot of time stressing, right? You need a better set of initial assumptions than the ones that every spiritually conscious person on this planet is using, because those assumptions are producing an emergency situation.
Chris?
Yeah.
How do the normal worlds evolve without adversity?
Well, they have adversity, just not on steroids like we do, right? And remember what they say. I mean, everyone needs adversity. You don't need it at sin and iniquity level, right? But you need it at error and evil level. And if the environment on a normal world doesn't naturally produce the requisite differentials so that you have the inevitabilities, you know, like we talked about last time, you've got, you know, that's the whole point of the material comfort era, like we talked about, remember, to actually have the contrast for the inevitabilities in existence for the first time, right? If that doesn't happen naturally, there's a whole order of beings whose job it is to see to it. We lovingly call them angels. But they actually are those that wield the hammer, right? Right? If the environment is not naturally adverse, they see to it that there's adversity, because there is no other path to paradise than through that. Right? I mean, you know, when you think about how we're transitioning, trying to get towards the age of spiritual striving, you know, it's all about getting a hold of wisdom. You know, and we know the only way to get at wisdom is through tribulation. So they'll lead you in troublous ways, you know, if you're not finding them naturally. You know, and then I'll get you into it. Yeah.
It's interesting to reflect upon Adam and Eve, that they, for the first time, had this really step out on faith when they came to this world.
Yeah.
And get to experience.
Poof! Yeah. They didn't make it 24 hours.
Right.
Because they were so used to the crutch of having that what they can see. They had never been stimulated enough to develop enough insight to be able to stand on their own when there's nothing to see, that which is not visible, as it were, right? You know, through insight. Right? I mean, and again, like we said, I mean, the 10 that are with, you know, in Van's group, right? I mean, they were selected because they had experiences that developed enough cosmic consciousness. That's why they're picked for that fallback group, right? Whereas Nod or others, you know, they hadn't had enough difficult experiences that stimulated enough cosmic recognition. And so as soon as there wasn't the crutch, you know, they collapsed just in a heartbeat. Right, so, that's what they're getting at. You know, so as we go to the next thing and, you know, and try to better understand that word that they coin, that they name us with. What is it about, right? And ask yourself whether or not you've really taken a hold of the challenge of being this this seemingly exalted designation that they're about to give us. Right? Have you gotten logical acumen at eye level by doing a chin up with your faith grasp? Or, you know, did you get to the religious impulse and decide that that was the end of the road, right? And you're just looking for one more profound feeling after another, right? It's all just about more and more sublime spiritual experiences that you can feel, you know, as you're laying down in the level of feelings, you know, immersed in it, right? Right? Is it just about you and your spiritual experiences? You know, or do you respond to the philosophic impulse? Right. Okay, so, that's right, I forgot to get back to you. Okay, go ahead.
So as you exercise your faith, you get better at it.
Yep.
Right? And as you do that, do you think that, especially in this world, that goes on with you in the manuals, in your soul?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And
can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. And getting better at it, you know, has a lot to do with this sublime confidence, this quality of confidence and cosmic reliability. Quote unquote, getting better at faith. What that is faith is grown into trust. The better faith is trust.
Does that go with you?
And that, yeah, I mean, when that's why they call it spiritual faith, but they call it soul trust. Right? When faith actually matures into trust, that is a substance that can be copied, right, into soul, made soul, right? And when faith matures into trust, you use the same analogy we were just using. You can stand on that trust, and now you have a new faith that you can only have predicated on that pre-existent trust. You can reach higher now that you're standing on trust. And then you mature that newfound faith into trust. Now you can stand on it, and then you can reach higher above that. That's your whole cosmic journey, is maturing faith into trust. Right? And the trust is literally realityized, is made substance as the soul. Right? And so the extent to which, that's why you hear me challenge everyone a lot to, don't just be in that beginning child of God mode where all faith does is antidote fear. Because if that's all your faith is doing, that faith hasn't matured into trust. You haven't supplied the favorable conditions for faith to be grown into trust and made soul. Right? All of your efforts are not being made soul. Right? You're spiritual but not religious, you know, if you will. It's just spiritual faith. So you want to supply those favorable conditions. I mean, Jesus challenged you with that favorable condition. He said, "Fear not." Right? You have to take on that challenge. I mean, obviously, you can't just, you know, snap your fingers and boom, all fear is blown away. But if you can take some little element of fear and have enough objective recognition to chuckle about it now, no, there really isn't a boogeyman under my bed like I was so afraid of when I was a little kid. Right? That fear has been conquered. It seems like a trivial thing, but it's not. No longer does faith have to antidote the fear of the boogeyman under the bed. That means you've supplied the favorable conditions for at least that little measure of faith to be matured into trust and made soul. One step at a time. Eradicate fear. Right. Right. Reality. Yeah, you know, you are realityizing. Because not only is that trust, you know, literally substantial, but it is patterned by your unique personality. How unique personality is it, you know, just in our analogy, for a hand to grab a hold of spirit substance and hang there? I mean, how unique of a hanging by your fingernails can you do? Not very unique, right? Yeah, it's all kind of the same, right? You haven't really gotten to your uniqueness if all you're using is just that hanging by your fingernails against fear or faith.
Sometimes that's how you start.
Yes, that is always how you start. I mean, and you can't start any other way. In other words, that's the way you're supposed to start, right? You know, and we kind of just saw why it's supposed to work that way. Why aren't you just given, you know, a cosmic foundation to stand on to begin with? Right, well, that's Havona natives, right? And we just saw how it's really handy that you have this reach up and grasp thing, because on some worlds you got to do a chin up. On a normal world, you don't. You know, the floor just floats upward. You know, and you're, you know, and the tide, you know, lifts all ships, right? Not a normal world. Not on this world, okay?
That's why they're given jobs and assignments that need to have that. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and that, I was joking at the beginning about being strong. Was it something to do with biceps? Well, actually, if you come all the way around full circle in the analogy, I do need some arm muscles if I'm going to do a chin up. With my faith grasp. And so.
Now you just contradicted the answer to my question.
Oh, okay.
How do we evolve without adversity? And if there's no tugging, and then you said adversity, yes, but not evil and.
Yeah, you don't need sin and iniquity. Remember, they point that out. You don't have to go that stark. You know, the inevitabilities don't need that stark a contrast.
But it's not going to be easy.
The adversity is going to be, remember the four indispensables in the early part of civilization, like we were just kind of going over there in detail again. Slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive. Slavery pretty automatically produces adversity. War, yeah, I think adversity usually rolls around pretty straightforwardly in war. I mean, it's just there, right? And war is the natural state. Every world has bucket loads of adversity, if for no other reason because of war. And I mean, you don't even have to go any further than that. You know, not to mention, obviously, social classes are going to produce adversity, profit motive. You know, in the material comfort era, you know, we got all this greed is going to produce all kinds of adversity. But that's the Father's way. It's your chance. How are you going to respond, positively or negatively, to adversity? But if there's no adversity, you can't do either. Right.
What's the point?
Right. The battery's dead. You know. Right. There has to be contrast, like they point out in the inevitabilities, or there can't be positive. All right. Okay. So let's do it. Let's go to the next paragraph here.
On Gerasim, the ascenders from these isolated worlds occupy a residential sector by themselves and are known as the Agendonters, meaning evolutionary will creatures who can believe without seeing, persevere when isolated, and triumph over insuperable difficulties even when alone. This functional grouping of the Agendonters persists throughout the ascension of the local universe and the traversal of the superuniverse. It disappears during the sojourn in Havona, but promptly reappears upon the attainment of paradise and definitely persists in the core of the mortal finality. Tabamantia is an Agendonter of finaliter status, having survived from one of the quarantine spheres involved in the first rebellion ever to take place in the universes of time and space.
Okay, let's deal with the last part there first. Now, Mary, I told you when we, you know, we stumbled upon Tabamantia for the first time in the book, you know, just a little bit back, when they were talking about how he was, you know, the overseer of all the decimal worlds in Nebadon, remember? And I told you, you know, we were going to get to him again. Okay, yeah, so here he is. You know, we get a little bit more about him here. So he's one of these, quote-unquote, Agendonters. You know, and the kind of interesting thing, apparently, the first rebellion was not just a planetary rebellion. I mean, apparently, the first rebellion was a system rebellion. You know, if you just take it at face value, what they're saying there, you know, one of the quarantine spheres. See, so it wasn't just a single planetary rebellion. Apparently, the very first rebellion was a system one. So it was a Lenana, you know, a primary Lenana deck that first, you know, put himself out there.
May not have been in this superuniverse.
Right? What was that?
May not have been. In this
no, most likely it was. Yeah, not. Yeah, in this superuniverse. Yeah. But you can imagine, you know, that once Pandora's box was opened, right, then there would be, you know, secondary Lenana decks on worlds, you know, that get this notion in their head, and, you know, and rebel is just a single world. But so it seems kind of logical, actually, when you think about it, that the first one would have been a full-blown system one, rather than a, you know, someone had notched down, you know, being that presumptuous. You know, but once, you know, it was out that a primary, you know, sort of validated this option, right? Okay, so Tabamantia.
You gotta have a few more.
Yeah.
The deck's gone bad.
Right, and then, you know, we've had three system rebellions in our local universe. Yeah. Okay, so there's that word that everyone loves to toss around, Agendonter. And just a you know, little interesting point to note, you know, one of our summer presentations in Perfecting Horizons Institute is that forging Agendonter steel. And one of the things that naturally comes out in that presentation is a greater illumination of the levels of meaning. Right? That isn't because, you know, there's this thing where we're using the levels of meaning, you know, in the same paper with Agendoner. That just comes out naturally, you know, as you unpack the idea of forging Agendoner steel. Levels of meaning is just a natural thing. And so you see how natural it was here, too, in this paper. You know, this secondary Linonadec that wrote this paper is right there in the immediate logic of that association as well. If you want to look towards that presentation this summer, that's something you could look to. Okay, but anyway, so this Agendoner a concept, meaning evolutionary will creatures who can believe without seeing. Okay, we were just talking about that, were we not?
Right.
Insight, instead of just sight. Persevere when isolated and triumph over insuperable difficulties, even when alone. Okay, you've got isolated, alone. Okay, that would be independent cosmic thinking. You have persevere and triumph over insuperable difficulties. That would be courageous, right? Courageous and independent cosmic thinking, right? And the insight that that gives you, you know, or that is inherent in that cosmic consciousness. That's what you're supposed to be about. And you're not going to get that by immersing yourself in the religious impulse. You have to stand up and let just your toes have the feelings, not your whole body. You got to get that philosophic impulse in front of your face. And you have to discover its enticing characteristics. And you have to start following it. Respond to that impulse. See where it takes you, right? Where it takes you is where you thought there was no place to go. It propels you up through the neck of the hourglass into the temple, right? Into relationship with the cosmos, right? And once you've experienced the kind of feeling that's a consequence of a cosmic experience, you'll never want to go back to one that's merely a spiritual experience ever again, right? You know, it'll pale, yeah? And you'll wonder why you ever was tempted to build a tabernacle and stay there forever, right, on the level of the feelings. Because the feelings that a triune experience produce are so sublime and so transcendent, right, that you never want to go back. That's what you're looking for. But it's, like Gene was saying, there's nothing in your initial child of God experience to give you any clue that such experiences are possible. He's just your spiritual father. He only is going to give you spiritual experiences. In order to have a cosmic experience, you need to find the other parent, the cosmic mother. Right? It's only in her wholeness, in contrast to his partness, right, that you can have this more sweeping, sublime experience, like we were talking about, you know, and as we went through, you know, the neck there in those developmental epics, how you've been initiated by the Father, you know, and then you found the way up to the other parent and began to develop that relationship. Right? It's not religion that produces the brotherhood of man. It's not the epic of religion and brotherhood. It's the epic of philosophy and brotherhood. It's not kindred spirits that produce one lick of the brotherhood of man. It's kindred minds. And only kindred minds. And no amount of believing that kindred spirits produces the brotherhood of man will get there. You'll be vainly hoping for the future forever. Not to mention regretting the past and whining over the present. It doesn't seem like that's what you want, you know, and fundamentally it's because you don't know what the word philosophy means. It's not the unfortunate thing that you have associated with that word.
That's a terrible course you never read.
Right.
You know? And it's not even a philosophy of living. Okay? A philosophy of living is what results from philosophy. It's not philosophy. Right? A personal living philosophy is downstepped into the outer life as a philosophy of living. Right? Philosophy is not something that you, about the way you move your body or rearrange the molecules in the outer life. Right? It's up in the temple. You know? And it is your relationship to the universal harmony, to the cosmos. And civilization is predicated on that philosophic mind. You can't have civilization with merely religion and science, with merely the fruits of the scientific impulse, the social impulse, and the religious impulse on the level of the feelings. It doesn't give you civilization per se, now, other than what you just have by grace, you know, that you just stumble into because we're, you know, made that way. Right? Like they say, you know, you have to get standing on the third and start, you know, looking at the fourth. Civilization has really arrived, you know, like they said. Only then.
So you're talking about this cosmic experience, mm-hmm. Different than a spiritual experience.
Yeah.
So do you have an example?
And another way you can think about it that maybe isn't so abstract is, what's the difference between a spiritual experience and a personal spiritual experience? Well, you know, the revelators give you a shorthand for personal spiritual experience. They call it a religious experience. So we could reword the question, what's the difference between a spiritual experience and a religious experience? When we're using it like that, when you're using that definition of religion, that personal spiritual experience definition, that's true religion you're talking about there. True religion only exists in a cosmic context. It doesn't exist in just a purely spiritual context. Okay? The word true means it's cosmic. True science, true religion, that means they're one of the phases of a triunity. They don't stand unto themselves. So if you have some sense of what's the difference between a spiritual experience and a religious experience, you know the essence of a cosmic experience. It's only that religious experience that's copied into soul, as they tell you in the Certitude of the Divine section in paper 102. If it's merely a spiritual experience, it has no survival value. It has no substance to it. It's just spirit flowing through your fingers, right? You know, or in the analogy, you know, washing over your body as you're laying down in the level of feelings. Right? You haven't taken a hold of it and given the adjuster permission to copy something into the soul. So that's the easiest way. The easiest way to begin to discover cosmic is to make that challenge yourself to try to find a differential between spiritual and religious. Religion is the spark for philosophy. True religion is the doorway. An actual personal spiritual experience. And remember, fundamentally, for it to be personal means you're exercising your will. That means your mind isn't just going with the flow of the laws of mind energy and the boundary conditions that your genetics put upon that mind. You've inserted yourself into that sequence. And you've said, B is not going to follow A, C is going to follow A. You've taken a hold of the reins of the spiritual experience. And you're exercising control over how you respond to a spiritual stimulus. Are you just passively feeling spirit? That's a spiritual experience. If you're dynamically engaged in it, right, then it's potentially a personal spiritual experience. And one of the false assumptions that immediately short-circuits this possibility of you taking a hold of the reins and trying to do something as well as be something try to be active rather than merely passive, is if you believe unchallengeably that spirit is innately divine, if you believe spirit is innately divine, why would you ever presume to grab a hold of it and try to do something proper with it if it's innately proper? But it's not. Spirit's not innately divine. It's just a substance. Okay? And if you just let it rattle around inside of you, subject to whatever random influences you impose upon it, don't be surprised if you don't like where it takes you. You need to get a hold of the reins, and you need to direct it in a positive direction, or it will not take you where you want to go. You will inexorably get the opposite of your spiritual desires. Okay? So that's the challenge, you know, is to recognize that you've got to get in there and get active somehow. You aren't looking for a state where you're letting go and melting into something. You may initially have to kind of do that to figure out there's this other place where you can kind of melt into, but that's not the point. The point is, okay, I've found there's another substance that gives me different feelings, because it's a different stimulus. Now I'm going to try to take a hold of this. And I'm going to begin to master using this. That's reflective thinking. You know, not just the passive state of meditating, if there's some genuineness to that meditation, but active. Reflective thinking. You're working with this. You're dynamically in play with it. That's what you're looking for, that. That's a religious experience. You know, remember what they say about, again, you know, religious may not always act wisely, may even act religiously, but they act. Okay, that's religionists, not spiritists. Spiritists bliss out. And religionists act. Right? See, so you got to be willing to go, you know, to jump in and act and discover down the road, whoops, right? I'm in tribulation. Oh, wait a minute, but tribulation leads to wisdom. So the next time I do this, it won't be such an oops. You've got to have the courage to get in there and start working with this. Okay?
So back on this particular paragraph, when it talks about the Agendoner status that, you know, leaves you going in Hieronym, and I can get that, but then it comes back.
Yeah, okay.
Can you explain
I was going to get to that. Yeah, so meanwhile, back to the paragraph about Agendoners. Sorry for the large tangent there. Okay, so that's the remaining little kind of question mark. Why does it disappear during the sojourn in Havona? You know, what's different about there relative to before or even after?
Even after. Right? That's what surprised me. It disappeared and then it came back.
If you go back, and maybe the... Here, why don't I just actually... tell you a place where they give you it very succinctly. In paper 30, let's see, it's almost at the end. It's in single column, page 343. Remember how that last section is entitled The Ascending Mortals? And they give you a synopsis, a thumbnail sketch of the ascension. And they get you up in item number 6 here, almost at the end of that paper, about Havona pilgrims. And they remind you that the journey from the super universe headquarters, it's the second paragraph in that subsection 6 about Havona pilgrims, the journey from the super universe headquarters to the Havona receiving spheres is always made alone. From now on, no more class or group instruction will be administered. You are through with the technical and administrative training of the evolutionary worlds of time and space. Now begins your personal education, your individual spiritual training. From first to last, throughout all Havona, the instruction is personal and threefold in nature, intellectual, spiritual, and experiential. Okay. Remember how they tell you, you know, that your real spiritual ascension begins when you get to Havona. Personality is spirit pattern. When you can really begin to manifest that profoundly unique personality. Okay. as they're stressing there, it's a personal education. Right? Each personality is absolutely unique. So you can't, you know, there's no group possibility. Right? There's no similarity between your absolutely unique personality and someone else's. You can't be taught together in pairs or something. Right? Your personality is absolutely unique. Right? So when they're talking about you being part of a group of Agendonters, right, that's not there when you're in Havona. Because it's fundamentally personal.
You're no longer part of class 16.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, or at the very least, you know, as they said there, occupy a residential sector by themselves. Right? You know, maybe it's not actually class, but you know, you're at least dorming together, right, or whatever. Right. I mean,
but then in paradise you could be.
Once you're out of Havona, once you've done that, you know, that getting yourself in relationship to the existential thing, you go back to the regularly scheduled programming of the experiential, right? And you've got this common experience of being Agendonters. Okay?
Makes sense.
Yeah. So that's the key thing there. You got to, and we remember we stressed that a lot, that, you know, that... it sounds a little scary right now. Do you think about that? Just you, you know, and infinity. You know, but remember, they tell you, no, you're fully ready to take on that without feeling alone or whatnot. You got lots of helpers too, if you know, if nothing else. But remember how you feast. I always like to point to Chris when we do this.
Yeah, thanks for catching me.
You feast on what?
Feast on uncertainty, fathom, discipline.
Yeah, that's
right.
In
the face of
thank you.
Yeah, that whole you know bit. Remember, yeah, as long as we're there, I'll remind everyone where that is too. So that's in the. Let's see. That's when you're at the. See if we can find that really quick. Oops, I haven't gone far enough back. That's my problem. Okay, so if you go to paper, let's see here. Oh, sorry, I wasn't ready for that one. Okay, here it is. So this is paper 26, section 5. It's old single column, page 291, the third paragraph. But long before reaching Havona, these ascendant children of time have learned to feast upon uncertainty, to fatten upon disappointment, to enthuse over apparent defeat, to invigorate in the presence of difficulties, to exhibit indomitable courage in the face of immensity, and we were just speaking to that one, and to exercise unconquerable faith when confronted with the challenge of the inexplicable. So you've got what it takes once you get there. To take on infinity and eternity all by your lonesome, as it were. All right.
And have lunch at the same time.
Yes. Yeah, and get a full tummy at the same
happy
time.
Happy man. God with you.
Right, right. I mean, yeah. You're so not alone. Remember, the number of beings in the central universe is beyond your numerical concept. Yeah, so, yeah, it's a little hard to be all alone. Anyway, you know, you take on the challenge alone. You know, like you have to get that personal experience with the Father, just you, right, by yourself. You know.
So it's not saying you're not any longer an Agendonter per se. You're just not an Agendonter.
Right. You just there's no collective you know expression going on because it's so definitively individuated. Right. Okay, let's see, so I think we unpacked everything there. Yeah, so let's just get the last little bit then.
All through the paradise career, reward follows effort as the result of causes. Such rewards set off the individual from the average, provide a differential of creature experience, and contribute to the versatility of ultimate performances in the collective body of the finaliters. Presented by a secondary Lanana Dex son of the Reserve Corps.
All right, so just notice how they want to leave it, just with that little reminder that the whole point is differential. Right? The point is not for everyone to find unity and melt back into it drops of water in an ocean, like some people on this planet believe. Right? The point is absolute individuality that cannot melt back, even in the face of infinite deity, that stands unmoved in the infinitely transcendent unity of infinite deity. You have absolute integrity as an absolutely individuated, absolutely unique personal expression in the universe of universes, in infinity even. But it's all predicated on the differential. Right? The only thing that's not in the concept of the infinite I am is true relationship, because there's no differential. So there can't be relationship. And that's the one thing that's missing in that infinite concept. That's what it's all about. And so they're just reminding you that, that this, when all is said and done, this is yet another way. The potential is established because differential is brought into existence and a superadditive consequence can result. There's no superadditivity in the infinite I am. All right. Okay, so that's how they end it there. And we're reminded again of the inevitabilities and the differential, how we had to naturally bring those up when we were talking about the material comfort era. So you can see how it all just kind of comes full circle and has a very nice tight completeness to it. All right, let's move on to paper 51. So they gave us the planetary princes and everything else they could give us that sort of immediately synchronized with it in the process, like we just saw. What are they going to give us with the planetary atoms? Remember, we are in this block of papers about the inhabited worlds. All right, so, that's the basic point. You notice the title of the paper is not Material Sons and Daughters. You know, it's not a paper all about them on local system headquarters worlds. The whole point is to think about the Material Sons and Daughters functioning on the inhabited worlds. That's the block of papers we're in. And that's what we were doing with the planetary prince. That's why it ended up having so much about the details of the development of civilization on a world. Because that's what we're fundamentally in here. All right, so what do they give us here to start out?
Excuse me, Chris?
Oh, yeah, you got something on the webinar?
One question from Kermit. What peculiar advantages might accrue to us by having the Urantia in our material phase? How might this differentiate us from others hailing from quarantined worlds, at least in the mansion world phase?
Yeah, I mean, what exactly does the fifth epical revelation offer in this regard? The ability for us to just have this hour-long conversation that we just had, to have a great deal of ignorance about all these unseen things melt away in the recognition that we just unpacked. Think about that neighboring planet, that poor neighboring planet, you know, that they do disclose a little bit about, and how dark the world is that they're struggling in, even on the island continent, you know, of relative light. As we say all the time, we can only hope with the revelators, you know, as they hope at the end of that paper, we can only hope with them that they've gotten that magisterial sun. So that there is some help. This revelation was given to us so that, those who were ready to take on the challenge of insight had a means of getting into that inscrutable domain Humans have been trying to do this on their own for 2,600 years and have not gotten very far. Right? The greatest philosophers have been trying to do what we were just describing by pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. And there are distinct limits to how successful you can be without what we have in our laps right here. And we need that. We need to be able to think clearly about these things like we just talked about. Now that I know what my basic what the basic task that's put before me is, I can set to it. Instead of spending centuries like, well, is it this, Lord? We try that for a few decades or a few centuries, and that doesn't seem to go anywhere. Is it this, Lord? And we try that, we've just been, randomly picking things, hoping this was the way for a long time. Now we've got what we need. You know that the basic thing that you should be about is mastering yourself. And it's only a personal living philosophy alive in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind that can master that self in the lower domain. Now that's what you're looking for. You're looking for what results when you stand up in the level of feelings and follow that other impulse, that highest impulse, that philosophic impulse. And you see where it takes you. That's what you're supposed to do. No matter how much it doesn't appear to be that's what you're supposed to do. It is what, the revelation is here to tell you that which really is, despite all appearances to the contrary, right? If it was apparent, you wouldn't need revelation. It's not apparent. It can't be apparent that you're supposed to follow that other impulse, or that there even is another impulse. You're certain that your religious impulse initially is the highest impulse, right? Every Urantia book reader, the first thing that they say when they're told about the adjutants is, why isn't the spirit of worship the seventh adjutant? Because it's the highest thing. Every reader says that because they don't even know the philosophic impulse. They've never experienced it in their life. They believe that the religious impulse is the final impulse. And they testify to it by how they respond to seeing that the spirit of wisdom is seven.
And they're programmed that way.
right? In many ways, we are, right? Because we don't have the outside helpers to encourage us otherwise, right? That's the thing. It's not apparent what the revelation is telling you, that the greatest adjutant is the philosophic impulse. That philosophy, true philosophy, is higher than religion. It's higher than science. It's the super additive consequence of the relationship between science and religion. It's above. Like the seventh adjutant is above. Right? That's not apparent. It's never been apparent to almost anyone that's ever lived. So the revelation is here to tell you that that's what it is. Believe that. Trust that. Try it out. Stand up. Let go of emotionalism. Stand up. Right? And find something new that you didn't know existed. You didn't know existed. All right, let's see what we got here with the planetary atoms.
Paper 51, the planetary atoms. During the dispensation of a planetary prince, primitive man reaches the limit of natural evolutionary development, and this biologic attainment signals the system sovereign to dispatch to such a world the second order of sonship, the biologic uplifters. These sons, for there are two of them, the material son and daughter, are usually known on a planet as Adam and Eve. The original material son of Satania is Adam, and those who go to the system worlds as biologic uplifters always carry the name of this first and original son of their unique order.
Okay, so two parts of that. First half of that paragraph, reminding you of that basic thing, that you've got this evolutionary process, biologic evolution. It's slowly going up and up and up, but it begins to asymptote. You know, Max is out. Right? The life carriers are right there that whole time watching that, and as soon as it reaches that asymptotic height, that plateau, that evolutionary plateau, they call for biologic uplifters, because the whole point is not to just flatline, you know, on that plateau forever. You got to keep going up. All right, so you get the biologic uplifters that come in and keep it going up beyond what evolution can do. Just a little aside, we were talking about the fifth epical revelation. That's the same thing that happened. Evolutionary philosophy, you know, had maxed out and plateaued at the beginning of the 20th century. So we were given a philosophic text so that those who wanted to could continue the journey upward, right? And without it, right? Instead of just staying at the evolutionary heights that we'd reached, right, we quickly started rolling off, you know, and we're heading almost straight down now, now that we've gotten to the 21st century, right? We're in full philosophic collapse, and civilization's in jeopardy. All right, so, but then that last part, okay, so they say, these sons, for there are two of them, okay, so the first thing he goes, reminder that in general, they're called material sons. Right? Specifically, they're called sons and daughters. Why, in general, are they called sons? Why, instead of daughters or neither? If they're called sons in general, that means fundamentally they are a father-like hand. They're sons of the Father, right? They're an offspring phenomenon of the Father functioning. They're an injection into place. They're functioning in a father-like, you know, interventionary fiat injection sort of a way. Now, of course, they're synchronizing with evolution always, you know, but obviously they're inserting themselves in. They're part of the descending sons. Okay. And then they say, are usually known on a planet as Adam and Eve. You're going, oh, so every planet knows Hebrew. No, that's probably not what it means. Right, because Adam and Eve are Hebrew words. Right, so, okay, what do they mean there when they say they're known as Adam and Eve? Obviously, they're wanting you to go to what's behind the sequence of Latin letters that's a transliteration of a sequence of Hebrew letters. You know, what's the literalness behind the word? Well, it's the etymology of Adam and of Eve. The word Adam in Hebrew fundamentally means the archetype human. You know, sort of the human being. Now, in a dim memory sense, what did that become? It literally became the first human being. You know, so it's an archetype by default then, if it's the, you know, literally the first one. But see, the truth of it is, right, it's the archetype human being. So in other words, they're saying Adam and Eve arrive and everyone goes, ooh, that's like a perfect human specimen there. That's what we all should be biologically going towards. That's what we want to be like, right? The archetype human. And Eve means life. So when they say that they're known as Adam and Eve, you know, they're always referring to the material daughter as the source of life, the font of life. Right? I mean, it's out of her womb springs the offspring, of the two. Right? The revelators did the exact same thing, took that exact same spirit, when they coined names for the actual first two humans, and an infanta. Right? And I put it next to myself here just so I could remind you. Remember how there's this etymology, you know, in the library. If you ever want to look up some things, there are some of these that I've done. And if you flip through there, you'll see, for instance, I've got fanta, one of the ones I've unpacked in there. You know, the A means first. It's capitalized, so it's the first. And font means source, right? So it literally means the first source. And when you have the ones that end in just A, there's always a an assumed element that you have to recognize. I mean, the first source for true human offspring. Yeah, that's the literal meaning of fonta, the first source for true human offspring. See, so it's, you know, just like Eve in Hebrew. Just a, you know, they just picked a different different way of saying the same thing than using Hebrew. And then you flip a little further and you find Andon. The A-N again is first. I mean, you know, A is short for A-N. You know, it just means first. Capitalized, it's the first. And then the Don, that word means, I mean, one way you can translate that is true human man. You know, I was doing the archetype human, you know, description for Adam. Right, so the literalness of Andon is the first true human man. And see, so that's all they did, is they just, they said, well, they think Adam and Eve are the first. Let's take the truth of those two names. The actual first, we'll call them basically the same thing as Adam and Eve. Just use different different root languages, right? We'll call them Andon and Fonta. Okay, so the names were right. They're, yeah. Yeah, not to mention, you know, what it would be, you know, if you weren't using, you know, Latin and Indo-European, you know, Northern European and whatnot stuff, yeah. Okay, but, you know, or what you would call them in the local universe tongue or, you know, or whatever, yeah. Yeah. Anyway. okay, so that's what they mean, that they're usually known in that way, that you've got this archetype, you know, and his complement, who's the wellspring of life, right? And then they say the original material son of Satania is Adam. See, they're doing the same thing, right? See, okay, if you want to really think about who's the archetype material creature in a particular local system, right, you have to go to the original material son and daughter. So they're just, you know, encouraging you to take the truth of this, what we're talking about, all the way back to the beginning fact in each local system. Right? There is an archetype material creature in each local system. There's an Adam, quote unquote. Okay. So, right, we were talking about how the planetary prince and his staff were the civilizational uplifters. Now you have it directly, right? These are the biologic uplifters. You know, as we all, you know, remember about them. And it's just again, that whole bit of you can sort of actualize the potentials welling up in the ministry of the mother. So you've got this full sort of actualization of the placeness, but then you need to have a material son and daughter to come in and inject direction into that place, to uplift most fundamentally the seventh adjutant, right, and bring direction into the favorable conditions of actualized substance, of actualized place. And now you've got the whole duality going. So that's what the biologic uplift is about. All right, let's get some more here.
These sons are the material gift of the Creator Son to the inhabited worlds. Together with the planetary prince, they remain on their planet of assignment throughout the evolutionary course of such a sphere. Such an adventure on a world having a planetary prince is not much of a hazard, but on an apostate planet, a realm without a spiritual ruler and deprived of interplanetary communication, such a mission is fraught with grave danger.
As we know, and we now have reminded ourselves more precisely of why. Because they normally depend too much on sight. They've gotten used to sight. And they just don't innately have enough insight on their own to handle it. You know, like we pointed out, you know, that very first night, our Adam and Eve You know, sun's gone down, it's literally visually dark, and they're thinking, yeah, boy, isn't that the truth? It is darn dark on this planet, isn't it? You know, and it's like, no, it appears dark, but it isn't really Adam and Eve. They needed someone to say that to them, but there wasn't anyone to say that to them. Right? And so they believed that appearance was a reality, and they despaired, you know, and the inevitable played out inexorably 100 years later.
What about
Solonia? Right? But see, again, you know, you're reminded, it's like, well, what about all those people there that could have said that? It's like, well, they tried some, right? But again, you know, it's, you know you're there to be, you know, the leaders of the planet, right? You know, so you might have needed to be a little bit more humble. I see one of those cosmic qualities. You know, they needed to be more patient and all those sorts of things.
It's just like when you get taken care of at home and all that, and you get sent out to boarding school or something like that.
Yeah, or you finally leave home, but when you go back and visit mom, you plop down on the couch and open your mouth and wait for her to feed you. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, ease drifting souls. All right, yeah, so grave danger, right? See, that they'll become dominated by that which isn't real, but appears to be so. Okay.
Although you cannot hope to know all about the work of these suns on all the worlds of Satania and other systems, other papers depict more fully the life and experiences of the interesting pair, Adam and Eve, who came from the core of the biologic uplifters of Gerasim to upstep the Urantia races. While there was a miscarriage of the ideal plans for improving your native races, still, Adam's mission was not in vain. Urantia has profited immeasurably from the gift of Adam and Eve, and among their fellows and in the councils on high, their work is not reckoned as a total loss.
Okay, two things, the funny chuckle at the end. Not reckoned as a success, but it's not reckoned as a total loss. is the cup half empty or half full? But notice a little challenge in there. Again, to go beyond how it appears. Your sight is not going to get you what you need to recognize what they just said there. It says that Urantia has profited immeasurably. Right? See if you can develop enough insight to see that, quote unquote, right? To know that, to recognize that. That despite all appearances of the contrary, we have immeasurable profit from that little drop of biologic uplift that we got, relatively speaking. That's a challenge. Because the appearances are quite the contrary. You're pretty sure you don't need a very long ruler at all, let alone being immeasurable. Right? You know, if you want to go volume-wise, you're pretty sure they don't even make measuring cups that small. Right? And you may have to resort, you know, to tiny little teaspoons and, you know, and quarter teaspoons and thimbles and, yeah, yes. Right. That's what it appears. So, you know, how do you resolve that? I mean, we talk about that all the time. You know, don't immediately assume that when they say we've profited immeasurably, that is actuality that's immeasurable, right? Your sight sees the actuality, and your sight is validly seeing the thimble thing, right? Your insight can see the potential. Right, it's the mustard seed thing. You know, Jesus tried to use that analogy all the time. Right, you'd never guess that mustard seed, you know, right? Because you look at the actuality of it, and it gives you no clue. But if you can see the potentiality of that mustard seed, right, you get a very different picture. Right? That's what they're trying to get you to do. Use your insight to see the potentiality that Adam and Eve put on this planet. Don't judge the profit by the actuality. That's what they're getting at. Again, insight. So Eigendonner potential, right? That's an Eigendonner can see potential instead of just actual. So you may like to call yourself an Eigendonner again, but you're not truthfully calling yourself an Eigendonner if you're judging everything by actuality. You know, and you're using your spiritual consciousness as an error and evil detector. And it's a very, very long list that it detects. Right? Because there's almost no positive actuality to be seen. Right? So, you're an Eigendonner in name only. Try to put some truth into that designation that's given you. Develop some insight. All right.
1. Origin and nature of the material sons of God. The material or sex sons and daughters are the offspring of the Creator Son. The universe Mother Spirit does not participate in the production of these beings, who are destined to function as physical uplifters on the evolutionary worlds.
So there you finally understand why they said these sons are the material gift of the Creator Son, up there in that second paragraph in the preface. If you had forgotten, there it is, that reminder. Remember, they're just coming from the Creator Son. So no wonder they're called sons in general. Right? They're just a downstepped expression of the Creator Son. And then you get this delightful discovery that when you downstep a Creator Son, it splits into two. And you go, there's more than the dominant element. There's a recessive element. When you downstep it, they both come out. Right? Because, you know, as we point out all the time, one of the Creator Son's parents is the Universal Father. Right? The other one is the Eternal Mother Son. Right? Those Creator Sons are made post-Eternal Son experiencing in Havona and getting Mother Deity added to the Son-type deity. Right? It's the Eternal Mother Son that's the parent of a Creator Son. So you have father and mother coming together, and that pops back out again when they downstep and make material sons and daughters. Right? If it was just the Eternal Son, there's no way you could get a daughter out. Right? You know that the parent must be the Eternal Mother Son and not just the Eternal Son. Okay. What else I got here?
The material order of sonship is not uniform throughout the local universe. The Creator Son produces only one pair of these beings in each local system. These original pairs are diverse in nature, being attuned to the life pattern of their respective systems. This is a necessary provision, since otherwise the reproductive potential of the atoms would be non-functional with that of the evolving mortal beings of the worlds of any one particular system. The Adam and Eve who came to Urantia were descended from the original Satania pair of material sons.
All right, so like we've said a number of times, you've got this particular specific life pattern in a given local system, and the Creator Son makes a material son, an original material son and daughter that matches that plan, you know, that life plan, that specificity in that local system.
Material suns vary in height from 8 to 10 feet, and their bodies glow with the brilliance of radiant light of a violet hue. While material blood circulates through their material bodies, they are also surcharged with divine energy and saturated with celestial light. These material suns, the Adams, and material daughters, the Eves, are equal to each other, differing only in reproductive nature and in certain chemical endowments. They are equal but differential, male and female, hence complemental, and are designed to serve on almost all assignments in pairs.
Yeah, that last little bit, you know, we stress that so often. I mean, they're designed to serve in pairs. You know, they just will inexorably fall on their face if they try to do things by themselves, right? Because they're so definitively, you know, a twofold expression. They're not quasi-so like we are, You know, I'm male, but not as definitively male as a material son, you know, and you're female, but not as definitively female as a material daughter, right? I mean, they are just, they're fully bifurcated. You know, we're only quasi because we need to be able to take up the slack a little bit of the other one, you know, if the vicissitudes of life on a mortal world come into play and one parent is lost, right? The other one has to be able to take up the slack a little bit. And Adam and Eve, right? I mean, an Adam can't take up the slack for Eve. This is, you know, no, he's just lost, you know, without the other half. He can't reach down deep and try to somehow find that recessive element, you know, and bring it to the surface. You know, it's just not there. Yeah.
I think it's really, really interesting. Coming from a Catholic background, with all of the paintings, all the old paintings mm-hmm. of the saints and all such,
yeah.
they always have, of course, the...
The halo, yeah.
The halo, and this is directly related to the Adam and Eve. So traditionally, it must have come down.
Right.
They had this...
Yeah, I remember they tell you that in the book, that tradition came from them wearing clothing, and at night, you know, their head is, you know, exposed, and so their head is glowing in the dark. Okay, so let's get that physics in there. Now, the part that you can understand is the up front. Right? I mean, they're basically material body with all the plumbing and whatnot like we have. Okay. But the mechanical mind that engages them engages the fullness of mechanical mind. You know, a prokaryote needs the sort of the minimal amount of mechanical mind. You go all the way to material sons and daughters, and they're using the full mechanical mind. That full mechanical mind energy engaging their body, it literally produces, you know, this visible consequence. That this radiant light of a violet hue. I mean, that's that literal, the energetics of that full mechanical mind engaging that body. Okay, the thing that they, you know, so that's, you know, with a little bit of reflection, you can figure that out. But the thing that they'd never give you enough to really get anywhere with, and often speak kind of poetically about, like they just did, you know, surcharged with divine energy and saturated with celestial light, you know. The physics, you know, they're about to mention, they're semi-material. There's more to them than just the basic molecular thing done fancy that we understand. There's some other aspects to them that they don't explain fully, that they leave you to just to try to wonder about a bit, okay? And that's what they're alluding to there. Perhaps with time, maybe I've got it sort of reflecting in the back of my mind for years. Maybe I'll figure it out some more down the road some. But it's right now it's just kind of a mystery, exactly what energies they may hint at in the book might be involved here that you could figure out, put two and two together. But anyway, you know that they're a little bit more than just fancy us, you know, taking the bottom all the way up, so to speak, right? Because they very naturally can see all kinds of spiritual beings, lower spiritual beings and stuff, right? You know, so they've got to have more than just, you know, the ability to do material sensing stuff, you know, like we can. You know, no matter how fancy you make my material senses, they're not going to see spirit energy, right? So they've, you know, it's obvious that they have to have more to them energetically in terms of their body than just matter. Yeah, but exactly what, we don't know. All right, let's keep going here.
The material sons enjoy a dual nutrition. They are really dual in nature and constitution, partaking of materialized energy much as do the physical beings of the realm, while their immortal existence is fully maintained by the direct and automatic intake of certain sustaining cosmic energies. Should they fail on some mission of assignment or even consciously and deliberately rebel, this order of sons becomes isolated, cut off from connection with the universe source of light and life. Thereupon, they become practically material beings destined to take the course of material life on the world of their assignment. and compelled to look to the universe magistrates for adjudication. Material death will eventually terminate the planetary career of such an unfortunate and unwise material son or daughter.
You could do that, but that would be unwise. Okay, so you can see them, again, see, referring to what we were just talking about, this dual nature, right? And notice that it's like what we were talking about with the non-breathers. That you've got the master physical controllers who are ministering energy on a world, right? So there's energies that we currently aren't, you know, we don't understand in the environment. And in Adam and Eve are literally pulling some of that energy out of that environment and are being sustained in part by that. Right? So they can have a much more limited material diet because they have this whole other diet, you know, where they're feeding on energies, you know, they're tapping into energies that really are synchronized with this other energetics of their natures, you know, that's not material. Okay? And just like those non-breathers, you know, are made to be able to tap in, sort of be fed by, if you will, the master physical controllers. But you notice that they're, you know, don't take that too literally. It's not like the master physical controllers have a spoon and they're shoving it into someone's mouth here. It's, you know, how do they say that? They're direct and automatic intake, right? Okay. But, you know, again, the master physical controllers are maintaining the energy just so that the beings that need to automatically can pull it out of the environment. And of course, when they're actually in Adam and Eve on a planet, they've been downstepped. We're about to read about that. You know, and the fruit of the tree of life is involved in completing this link between their nature, you know, and this input. You know, like I've said before, the easiest way to think about it is normally they're at eye level to that input and they just bring it in, but they get downstepped, and so you need this, whatever the energetics are from the fruit of the tree of life that bridges that vertical gap, right, and gets the input down to where they are, you know, and somehow brings it down and engages them then. Okay, but when they haven't been downstepped like that, and I'm about to talk about that.
An original or directly created Adam and Eve are immortal by inherent endowment, just as are all other orders of local universe sonship. But a diminution of immortality potential characterizes their sons and daughters. This original couple cannot transmit unconditioned immortality to their procreated sons and daughters. Their progeny are dependent for continuing life on unbroken intellectual synchrony with the mind-gravity circuit of the spirit. Since the inception of the system of Satania, 13 planetary atoms have been lost in rebellion and default, and 681,204 in the subordinate positions of trust. Most of these defections occurred at the time of the Lucifer Rebellion.
Okay, let's deal with the rebellion, you know, last here. Let's, we're just talking about the energetics. Let's talk about that first. All right, so you have that original pair, as they say there. I mean, even though they're material, I mean, they're just like seraphim and, you know, archangels and what have you, Melchizedeks. They're just innately immortal. But that diminution of immortality, in other words, okay, there's this downstepping. When they procreate, their offspring are downstepped from that original pair. And now it's, you know, there's prerequisites, right? They're only plugged in contingent upon certain things being just so. Okay, and notice the little clue there about this additional energy nature of their body and them being connected to these inputs, that it has to do with their mind energy being in equilibrium, synchronized with the cosmos. And if they get themselves out of whack with the universal harmony. If that literal mind energy isn't coordinated properly, they literally come unplugged from these inputs that are sustaining them against the second law of thermodynamics, you know, and similar decay sorts of phenomena like that, right? They begin to unravel. You know, and it's a very subtle thing. Remember, we're talking about, aging has to do with the life animation, you know, and how it's mysteriously related to dead matter, making it living matter. And no one, not even the life carriers understand that. It's all very mysterious how this life animation is identified with matter. But, you know, they can tell that the identification degrades with time, right? And that's the fundamental reason why you age. It's the fundamental reason why these Adams and Eves, when they come unplugged, you know, and start to take a natural course, quote unquote, and they begin to age and eventually die. All right, so you got clues like that the literalness of mind energy is somehow very important in staying connected to these inputs. And like I said, it's little hints like that that have got me trying to figure this out, but I haven't been able to sort it out totally yet. But when we get it, when I eventually offer the Pattern Universe course, we might talk about how what you discover when you unpack the Pattern Universe leads to thoughts about what you might do with this statement here. But anyway, so you just have this basic fact that that they've got to stay in right mind, if you will, right? You know, rightness, righteousness means conformity with the cosmos. They have to stay in conformity with the cosmos. And if they don't, you have this very literal thing that happens. Okay, well, you must have a downstepped expression of that. Okay, there must be a truth of that in you. Even though you aren't factually like this, right? Think about the truth of what that means for you, right? Because you're basically a downstepped expression of the archetype material creatures, those, you know, that first pair of material sons and daughters. So how important does this say, this thing synchronized with the cosmos is, like we were talking about so passionately in the previous paper? It must be important. Even if you don't have such a visible consequence like an Adam and Eve do, right, if they're not in conformity with the cosmos. Right, so that's one of the fundamental truths that's flowing through that paragraph for you. Why is that important to you? Why is it important that they tell you that? It's got to be something that's worth considering for yourself. If it's so, grave danger consequences for them in play. And so now. The grave danger thing has unfolded several times. Yeah, it is interesting to note that only 13, and I guess you're supposed to assume pairs there. But I don't know. It's a little hard to know if it's just atoms there, or either way, even if it's just the atoms and not the Eves, it's still, it's a small number.
I'd say lean against, yeah. only because even though they number them as pairs, mm-hmm. it still took Adam making the deliberate choice to look for Laodicea.
Right, but the interesting thing that kind of seems to make you wonder is like, well, we're an example where Eve started it. Mm-hmm. Eve defaulted first. Mm-hmm.
I look at it as a pair.
I don't know. I mean, we can just leave that as an open thought for the moment. But another thing that I have a hard time saying, if it's only Adams, then the Eves that would be quote unquote subordinate positions of trust. But they just pointed out they're equal. Yeah. It doesn't feel right. So yeah, Eugene.
Do we know how many inhabited planets have had rebelled?
Well, I mean, just, yeah, I mean, like I was saying, this is a small number, because just in our local system, you know, just in the third system rebellion, there's 37.
37.
All right, so.
So that means, that means there have been significant Adams and Eves on these rebellious planets who have remained.
Well, that's one thought you might have. Or you might say maybe the rebellion on those planets was before they had an Adam and Eve, so they. Right. I mean, it very well could have been that, you know, a lot of the worlds that went into rebellion, you know, were pre-Adam and Eve. So there's no Adam and Eve,
like we,
you know, to default and may still not be, right, an Adam and Eve, you know, at the time of the writing here. Right? So, yeah, I mean, there's different options, you know. I mean, it's a little hard to know exactly how to think about this.
But you would have guessed more.
Right.
Right. Maybe,
right. So, yeah, like I said, I mean, there's kind of all kinds of mysteries to this statement. However, it does remind you that, you know, there, you know, aside from them serving as Adam and Eve, these material sons and daughters are doing a lot of other jobs, like we talked about, you know, when we were going through the local system headquarters, you know, and so you've got, you know, like, you know, 200,000 years ago, you've got all kinds of these archetype humans that, you know, you're following their every move on the mansion worlds, and they join the rebellion, and, you know, like a lemming, you go off the cliff with them. You know, 681,204, that's a big number, especially when they say that most of these defections, and so...
95%.
Yeah, that's a lot, you know, to deal with. Okay, so, yeah. All right, let's see. I don't want to spend too much time. We're running out of time here. But anyway, so you know, there's kind of two elements to that paragraph, as you can see. But back to the physics thing. You know, just you know, try to get that kind of physics of them in mind. You know, of how important it is for them to strive to have cosmic consciousness and not just spiritual consciousness, say. Because if they get biased like that to their spiritual consciousness, they come and plug. You know, they've got to stay in cosmic equilibrium. All right.
While living as permanent citizens on the system capitals, even when functioning on descending missions to the evolutionary planets, the material sons do not possess thought adjusters. But it is through these very services that they acquire experiential capacity for adjuster indwellment and the paradise ascension career. These unique and wonderfully useful beings are the connecting links between the spiritual and physical worlds. They are concentrated on the system headquarters, where they reproduce and carry on as material citizens of the realm, and whence they are dispatched to the evolutionary worlds.
So a very, very long process, you know, going through all the planetary mortal epics, basically. Finally, they have a capacity grown within them, you know, where they can be modified at the end and get an adjuster and leave the planet. You know, but just think about, you know, what a long process it is for them to slowly acquire that capacity. You know, and especially now post-Pentecost, with the Spirit of Truth helping out, you've got a capacity right there at age six. Right? So, you know, just think about how much process is bottled up, you know, is eventuated in you, in that you get what they acquire over that vast, long bit of experience, all bottled up, eventuated into just a brief little acquirement, you know, handed to you ready-made. For them, that eventuated nugget that we get is stretched out in its full evolutionary detail. And they get it little bit by little bit until finally, when all is said and done, they've got that whole package. All right.
Unlike the other created sons of planetary service, the material order of sonship is not, by nature, invisible to material creatures like the inhabitants of Urantia. These sons of God can be seen, understood, and can in turn actually mingle with the creatures of time, could even procreate with them, though this role of biologic upliftment usually falls to the progeny of the planetary atoms.
I don't know. I don't think I needed that parenthetical about could even procreate with them. When they said mingle, I was already thinking. Mingle.
What about the word usually?
Remember that you've got all these exceptions like we talked about. There's all these different issues. Sometimes material sons and daughters do directly procreate, et cetera, et cetera. We talked about all that back, when we were unpacking some of that. But the normal run-of-the-mill thing is the Adam and Eve, even though they've been downstepped when they're from the local system headquarters, when they're made Adam and Eve, they're not downstepped enough yet. They're still a little bit biologically above the evolutionary world. And you need one more downstep notch when they procreate. And that's one of the changes that the life carriers make. Right? They don't procreate like they do on high, where they procreate horizontally. Here they procreate in a downstep fashion. That's why the usually, so that you've got the biologic compatibility. Violet races meeting evolutionary stock eye to eye. And you don't have this vertical tension tearing them apart inside we had, when you made it directly with Adam and Eve.
Didn't work out well for Laoda.
Yeah. Especially, if you're the one that has to give birth. Right. And that tension is inside of you. Yeah, you don't survive childbirth.
On Gerasim, the loyal children of any Adam and Eve are immortal. But the offspring of a material son and daughter procreated subsequent to their arrival on an evolutionary planet are not thus immune to natural death. There occurs a change in the life-transmitting mechanism when these sons are rematerialized for reproductive function on an evolutionary world. The life carriers designedly deprive the planetary Adams and Eves of the power of begetting undying sons and daughters. If they do not default, an Adam and Eve on a planetary mission can live on indefinitely, but within certain limits, their children experience decreasing longevity with each succeeding generation.
Several little points there to just bring out. Notice they use that word directly here of longevity. Right? We're not talking about life expectancy. We're not talking about something that's a function of the environment. We're talking about what's just genetically inherent. We're talking about inherent lifespan. We're talking about longevity, which is what they always do in the book. They might not always call it longevity, but that's what they're talking about is longevity, because the life expectancy thing is a function of the environment. Is that's sort of just a fact of very relative consequence. Not very important to know. You see it right direct. I keep jumping ahead basically in order to talk about this. There you have them talking directly about it. That when they rematerialize the material son and daughter as the Adam and Eve on a planet, they designedly downstep them, right, from where they were. And one of the things that manifests that downstepping very directly is when they procreate, their children are downstep even one more notch, like they're just describing there. And then not to mention, like I said, they need the tree of life now. When they're on our when our material sons and daughters are on Gerasim, they don't need the tree of life, right? Because they're not downstepped. That's why it's the shrub of Edentia, right, and not the shrub of Gerasim. Right? Needed on Gerasim.
Yep. Will the subsequent generations, after the first generation of their offspring, will they continue to until they come to the level of a normal?
Well, you know, we don't really know how, you know, you get this sense, you know, that there is a diminishing thing, but problem is, you know, they begin to blend in with the evolutionary stock, you know, very early on. So, right. Yeah. So, you know, this experiment of how far they taper down, you know, doesn't play out very long before they're mating with the evolutionary stock, right, and get pulled down.
But here they were taken off anyway.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, it seems like Eve. Well, a mother here, a mortal mother, comes to the end of her childbearing years. But she potentially could continue to have children indefinitely.
Yeah.
So it just probably, I would guess at some point there's law of diminishing returns. She may stop bearing children, but it wouldn't be because of lack of ability.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, they don't talk about that very much. You know, about in a normal process. I mean, how long did the original pair actually procreate? You know, it seemed like they wouldn't have to go on very long. I mean, eventually, you've got so many, you know, descendants that. But this sort of being able to procreate ad infinitum, it seems, you know, bears out even when you've got Adamson and Rada, right? You know, and I mean, here you've got, you know, a way down descendant of the Nodites, you know, in Rada, and look at how many children she could have. You know? it's pretty impressive stuff, you know, to be fertile that long. Right? So, yeah, obviously, you know, that. If you back that up, that means Adam and Eve, you know, seemingly must be fertile for a very long time, if not, you know, indefinitely.
And Rada was not young when she began having children, was she?
Well, no, she was pretty young. You know, it was Adamson that was, you know, was marrying quite young. Yeah. But the same way with, you know, Adam, you know, with Adam, you know, it's not just Eve, you know, Adam too, obviously, you know, just is fertile, you know, on and on and on and on and on. You know, one would suspect that there probably isn't any decay, you know, to that. I mean, as long as they're staying synchronized, right, you know, they don't age, they don't, you know, I mean, that's an aging thing, you know, to lose your fertility. So, anyway, let's see. Anything else we need to bring out there? There's one other thing that we might mention in passing here. There's an element that's never explained in the book. This whole bit about when you transport a material creature, you know, we all remember that sometimes when they talk about that, you know, they point out that now that they've been dematerialized and rematerialized on the other end, they can't procreate anymore. Like Midsoniters, when they're taken off their world, right? When they're rematerialized, they can't procreate anymore. Or the children of Adam and Eve that were taken off the planet, right, and taken to Adentia. When they were rematerialized, they can't procreate anymore. We'll get to that when we get to the Planetary Mortal Ethics paper, if I remember correctly. I think that's where they mentioned that those children of Adam and Eve can't procreate now on Adentia. And so you're going, well, wait a minute. I mean, if it's always the case that when you dematerialize and rematerialize, they can't procreate on the other end. What about every Adam and Eve? They're obviously procreating on the other end after they've been dematerialized and rematerialized. So you're left to wonder about this. You don't know if this is, for some beings, you can dematerialize them and rematerialize them and they can still procreate, or if the reason that they can't procreate is because that's how the life carriers rematerialize them. You know, is it? Yeah, it's, you don't really know if it's an inescapable part of the process, you know, or if it's, if you dematerialize and rematerialize in some sort of like higher level, then it does, then they can still procreate. But if you do it at a lower level, we'll get into that a little bit more as we, you know, go into this next section next time. But, you know, just you know, note that that's sort of latent here in this paragraph. This whole mystery about whether or not you're still able to procreate once you've been rematerialized and, you know, after transporting. What?
Birth control.
Yeah, it's a pretty harsh method of birth control. Yeah, to be dematerialized and rematerialized, but
depends on if you rematerialize in a nicer body.
But don't they say it takes like 3 days? I don't remember exactly how many days to put them all back together.
A long time. We'll get to that. Yeah, that's the next section. Yeah, see that.
Yeah, so I think that could negate the.
But the Adam and Eve don't have that potential.
Right. See, it's just, you know. I'm just, you know, reminding you right here, so, you know, so we can remember that we, you know, when we see this rematerialized, anyone who's familiar with the book, you know, that should, I think, wait a minute, I hadn't thought about that, rematerialized, you know, and then for reproductive function, it's like, wait a minute, so, you know, is it an option or what?
Well, their language, life-transmitting mechanism,
mm-hmm.
Procreation is a mechanism, apparently, and
right.
So... it's not some mysterious thing. It's a mechanical thing.
Right. Yeah.
So it must be, the reason for it might be much higher than the physics, but it sounds to me like it's the life, something the life carriers.
Right. See, it's just a question of, you got this mechanism, and is it that you can't put the mechanism back together? Does something come unplugged and you can't plug it back in? Or, you know, can you plug it back in but you choose not to?
But they don't.
Right.
This is
what it seems to be. Right, you know, just, yeah. You know, I'm just noticing that you're left to kind of speculate. It's like, well, it kind of feels like this to me, you know, but yeah, anyway.
It's Star Trek. It's electronic.
Yeah, and definitely you want to, yeah, well, you know, we'll talk about it a little bit more next time too, but, you know, if, you know, the one measure of truth, if you will, to the Star Trek transporter is this process, you know, of dematerializing and rematerializing. The only difference, though, is, remember, they're not turned into an energy beam and, you know, beamed like in Star Trek. I mean, this dematerializing is... You change them from a material molecular structure to basically a Maranta-like structure that can be transported, and then you translate it from that Maranta-like structure back into a material structure, right? So, I mean, it isn't dematerialized, you know, in the extreme sense that we immediately think of, you know, especially because of Star Trek, you know, where you literally watch them sparkle and unravel, right, and just become, you know, diffuse energy. No. I mean, they somehow are just, you know, modified, you know, morphed into something that's transportable and then morphed back. All right. Well, let's wrap it up there. And we'll continue on next time. Let's take a moment here, everyone.